This is Upfront. I'm Sandeep Roy. A lot of secrets and passions and pain get swept under the carpet in Anita Amirazwani's debut novel, The Blood of Flowers. A lot more gets woven into the carpet itself. The Blood of Flowers is about a young woman in 17th century Persia who's forced to leave everything she knows and move to the fabled city of Isfahan. There she battles poverty, heartbreak, humiliation, and at the same time learns to weave the most wondrous carpets that can be the envy of the Shah's harem. At a time when Iran is mostly in the news these days under keywords like terror and mullahs, Anita Amirazwani goes back in time to weave a much richer picture of an ancient civilization. Anita Amirazwani, welcome to Upfront.
Thank you.
Now, the unnamed narrator of your book, this young woman who wants to be a carpet weaver, when you were researching the book, did you find there were a lot of people like her, or were most of the master weavers men?
Rug making exists in Iran and existed at very many different levels. So there are individuals who work on their own looms in villages or among nomadic tribes, and did so hundreds of years ago in the time my book was set. And they made very beautiful products. But there were also rug makers who worked at quite a sophisticated level in workshops that were run, in some cases, by the royal family. And those rug makers were really the highest specialists of their craft. Undoubtedly, they were men who then produced rugs that were made out of silk, that were done with silver-wrapped thread, that were made with, for example, the coat of arms for the King of Poland in 1601. So the rug making really did exist at all different levels and still does.
And how then did you decide that you wanted your protagonist to be a carpet maker?
You know, I actually received a very special carpet myself from my father when I was 14. It's a basic wool carpet made with a very traditional pattern, a kind of sunburst and then flowers in these deep blues and deep red colors that are very traditional from Iran. And I've had this carpet with me for many years, and I was one day in my living room in the East Bay looking at it and thinking about how this carpet was not signed by anyone. And in fact, that's true of most carpets. They are unsigned works, except at the highest levels. And so it occurred to me that I had this beautiful craft, as well as embroidery and miniature paintings from Iran, and that I had no idea who the craftsperson was, and that I would actually never know. So my goal really was to create a life of a craftsperson like the person who made my rug, and to show what her life and her hopes and dreams might have been like.
And that's why you give her no name?
I give her no name with a real special intention, and that is to honor the work of the craftspeople through the ages, Iranian and from other cultures, whose work we love and admire, and yet we can't say thank you.
But the Persian carpet is such the ultimate lush stereotype even of that part of the world, you know, the thing that the Western tourist really covets. In fact, there's a Dutchman in your book who covets these carpets. And I wanted to ask you about how you use that stereotype to play with other stereotypes, like the role of women in Persian cultures. I was reading the book and thinking you were almost saying, I'll give you a ride on my flying carpet, but it's going to take you to a destination you don't really expect.
Well, I had several ideas in mind there. On the one hand, I think people do admire carpets here very much. And in fact, interesting statistics that Americans bought $100 million worth of Iranian rugs last year, the biggest single country consuming Persian rugs, despite the trade embargo. So we still love them.
But they think they're Persian rugs, not Iranian ones.
Well, that's something I can't help. But my goal then was to really get behind what is involved in making these carpets. And so I wanted to reveal the difficulty of the process. And in fact, I was reading recently that at least 8 million people are still involved in rug making in Iran. And that means raising sheep, spinning wool, making dyes, knotting the carpets, and then selling them. So it still is a very important industry for the country, which is otherwise in many ways quite modern.
And I know you were researched carpet making, obviously, for the book, but were you also researching 17th century female sexuality?
Not specifically. As far as I know, we don't actually have any, for example, memoirs by Iranian women from the 17th century. I have heard of a travel narrative, but I've also heard that it's not a personal account. It's more a classic account. So we have his political histories and so forth. So my goal, and I think this is something that we're really seeing in literature in the past 20, 30 years, is to give voice to the voiceless. So, for instance, the colonized of the world are now writing their histories in fiction about what it's like to be colonized. A great novel that I read recently, Cities of Salt by Abdulrahman Munif, is about the exploration of oil fields in a Gulf state from the point of view of the Bedouin. So I think it's really important thing to give voice to the voiceless, and that's what I wanted to do by looking at the lives of Iranian women in this century.
But how easy was that? You were born in Iran, but you grew up in Switzerland?
I actually grew up in San Francisco.
You grew up in San Francisco. So from your perspective, how difficult was it not to have you, the person growing up in a place like San Francisco, intrude into the life of this 17th century woman you were imagining?
Well, I consulted my family to get a sense of their take on what it might have been like, but I think all of us are at an equal distance from this history, and we all have the same access to the materials that are available. So it is an act of the imagination. However, I tried to base it on what seemed likely to me. And my protagonist, though a flawed individual, has very specific hopes and dreams and really pursues them with great vigor. And I don't think that that is unlikely or impossible. In fact, I think the stereotype, especially now, about women in Iran, well, it's just incorrect to think that they're somehow passive or not involved in creating their own destiny. So my character, although she faces restrictions and problems that limit her, is nonetheless pursuing her own interests as well as she can. And I think that's very likely.
And I was also astonished that she's not just pursuing her own interests. She is also learning to discover her sexuality, take pleasure in having sex. You confide in other women at the hammam that she goes to. And at some level, I was reading another book by this writer, Roxane Varzi, about modern Iranian women and men in contemporary Iran and how they skirt the morality police and how they get around and have their parties. And I was thinking, you know, these two women could be sisters under the skin.
Well, this is another stereotype I think we have in general in the West about people in the past. So I think what has happened is that our idea about Victorian prudery has basically extended to every culture in every time period. However, we know that, for instance, France in the 18th century was more libertine than the Victorians in the 19th century. And so I don't think there's any reason not to believe it possible that a married person in the century that I'm writing about in Iran would not consult other women in, you know, situations where it would just be woman to woman, asking questions, getting answers, and trying to basically fix a situation that she has a major problem with.
And did you find also, was it common at that time for people to end up in these kinds of 3-month marriage, quote unquote, marriage agreements that your character is confronted with?
This is the temporary marriage situation that you're referring to, and it's a very unusual thing that's part of Iranian culture. I found it interesting to explore because it's something we don't have in the West, and also, as you can imagine, it creates almost a Scheherazadean-like deadline for my heroine. But just so you know, typically these marriages can be as short as an hour and as long as 99 years, so there's an enormous span of possibility there. And as to the extent of how widespread it was in that period, as far as I know, there are no documents, and there probably never will be because these agreements can be made just person to person. So I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that question.
Now, did you yourself, when you were growing up, did you have to struggle with all kinds of expectations about, you know, what the good Iranian girl was supposed to be and supposed to do and what you wanted to do and become?
I did not. You know, my family actually, my Iranian family is, much of it is Western educated. So my father came to school at the University of Miami, got his engineering degree. My uncle also did the same. And so my family was very oriented toward progress and is oriented toward progress and toward the idea of building a better Iran. So I'm happy to say they actually did not put any restrictions on me.
So you didn't have to rebel at all?
I guess I'll have to do that later in life.
Let's actually hear a little bit from the book. Can you introduce the section?
I'll be glad to. My heroine experiences a very terrible family tragedy in the beginning of the book, which throws her whole life off course. But the result of that is that she goes to the capital city of Isfahan, which at the time was just being recreated by the great Shah Abbas. And I should note that the Great Square, the image of the world that's mentioned in this book, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and is quite beautiful. So when she gets to Isfahan, she meets a new friend by the name of Nahid, and this is a scene between the two of them. Whenever I had time, I visited Nahid. We were becoming close quickly now that we shared not just one secret, but two. After my first experience of seeing her name in ink, I had asked Nahid to teach me to write. She gave me lessons in her workroom whenever I visited. If anybody came to talk with us, I was to pretend I was just drawing. It was not common for a village girl to learn to write. We started with the letter Aleph. It was simple to draw, a heartbeat, and the letter was done. "It is long and tall, like a minaret," said Nahid, who always thought of shapes that would help me remember the letters. Aleph, the first letter in Allah, the beginning of everything. I filled a page with tall, straight strokes, watching Nahid out of the corner of my eye. Sometimes I added a curving top to the letter to give it a long, low sound in the throat. When my efforts had met with Nahid's approval, she taught me the letter Bay, which was curved like a bowl with a dot underneath. This letter was much trickier. My bay looked graceless and childish compared with hers. But when she looked over my labors, she was satisfied. "Now put the two together, Aleph and bay, and you make the most blessed thing in our land," said Nahid. I wrote them together and mouthed the word Ab, water. "Writing is just like making rugs," I said.
Thank you. That's Anita Amirrezvani reading from a book, The Blood of Flowers. Now, Anita, when you were growing up, what kind of stories were you growing up with? Because in the book, every time somebody comes to some kind of a moral crossroads, somebody tells a story or an ancient fable. Did you grow up with that kind of storytelling? And were you actually even paying attention to those kinds of stories in San Francisco?
I wish I could tell you that I grew up with these stories as though they came with mother's milk. But in fact, many of these stories come from the high literary tradition. And so I discovered them later when I was reading a lot into Persian literature. And I started to realize that although here we really have deep knowledge of, say, the Greek and Roman myths or some of the Arabian Nights and so forth, very few of these Iranian stories are known now in the West. And I wanted to share these because I think they are so very beautiful. So five of the tales in my book are retellings of classic stories, some of which are literally hundreds of years old. And then I had to make up two of them just to make it all work with a plot.
So what was it like for you to go back to Iran to research this book?
My father and stepmother still live in Iran, as well as other close and important members of my family. So it's really important for me to go see them, to be with them, and to experience life there. And in terms of the research, they drove me around all over the country to places that I wanted to see to do the work for this book, Isfahan, as well as other places. And I love going there. It's important, I think, for Americans to remember that there is public life, which is the life we tend to see on the news. And then more important to many people is the life in the home, which is where you do what you like.
And when you went there and you looked at how people were living, in fact, how carpet makers were living, what did you find? I love the story that you tell in your book about when Timur or Tamerlane the Mongol, when he ransacked Isfahan in, I think, the 15th century, he killed 50,000 people but spared the carpet makers. And for your character, the carpet making is a way out of her poverty and her situation, though, of course, it's not necessarily a glamorous profession. It has terrible health risks as well. What's it like right now?
it's a very hard job to do for anybody, very time consuming. It's, of course, it's not going to be paid except at the highest levels very well. But it still exerts an incredible fascination. And for instance, we were traveling in the city of Kashan, which in old times was very famous for its textiles. And in the hotel, a woman had set up a loom and the carpet was half finished, and she came every day to work on the loom. And the hotel staff told us that before these carpets that were made by this woman were ever finished, they were always sold. Because how can you resist?
You started by saying that, in a way, the story started when your father gave you a rug. Now that this book is over, when you look at that rug, do you look at it differently?
The wonderful thing about my carpet, and I think most Persian carpets, is that you can look at them for so many years and discover new details and new colors, new patterns, things you never saw before. So in a way, I see them as really deeply meditative, and I have never failed to find something new to look at in my carpet.
Thank you. Anita Amir Rezvani's debut novel is The Blood of Flowers.